Good morning, this is Grover Furr, and I'll be talking to you today about the eight main themes that I would like to use as introductions to the novels that we'll be reading this semester in world literature. These themes are intended to help you begin to think about the books we'll read in the course. Most of these themes recur in all the books we will read, and they all recur in most of the books we'll read. So they're very common. And in addition to that, they occur in many other works, both of non-Western literature, but also, to a significant extent, in Western and even in American literature. But of course, the emphasis can be different. I've designed them specifically as an introduction to the non-Western works we'll be reading this semester. These eight main themes serve a number of purposes. Number one, they get us started in the course. We have a couple of classes until you've read the first book. We can't really begin to discuss the novels themselves until you've read and done the assignments on the first book. So they take us through that period of time, but they do a lot more than that. These themes are designed to help you focus on similarities among the different books. If you're puzzled by strange names or unusual structures of narration in these novels, then if you focus on the themes, you'll be able to see similarities, points of contact between other novels you've read, maybe of Western literature, and these works of non-Western literature. And then once we've got one or two books under our belt, so to speak, you'll be able to notice similarities among the different works that we're reading in the course. And that helps understanding. Understanding in any field, whether it's the sciences or the humanities or in any other field, comes from noting significant similarities. If everything is different, then everything is unique and everything is incomprehensible. It's similarities that help us come to an objective understanding about the world. Now, keep in mind that you can pick other themes to write on if you wish. These are simply my attempt to concentrate on important themes. That doesn't mean they're the only themes, and it may not even mean that they are the most important themes, but they are themes that recur over and over in these books. So, before I get started, I'd like to encourage you to follow along in my talk with the handouts that I put on the World Wide Web. There's a link on our course page and our homework page to these handouts, which are actually in the form of a PowerPoint presentation. That is to say, they take the appearance of slides. I could use these slides in class and give this lecture. That's what I've done in previous years. But starting with this year, I'd like to try to use the lecture online in real audio format, the format that you're going to listen to it today, so that we can get a jump on the class, that when you do come to class, you'll have listened to the lecture, and you'll also have before you the PowerPoint presentation or the text version, both of which you can get online. And so that'll help you think of the main points of the lectures, and the lectures will help to fill in some of the details that are left out in the discussions. Now, I'm going to pause here for a minute before going on to the first theme. This is the first theme, imperialism and colonialism. Now, strictly speaking, the term imperialism has to do with building an empire. You probably have had some introduction in high school or in college about great empires of the world, starting perhaps with the Roman Empire. But of course, imperialism goes far, far earlier than that. Before the Roman Empire, there was the Assyrian and Babylonian and Egyptian empires, and of course, the empire, the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great. Imperialism, strictly speaking, means the process or the project of building an empire and maintaining it. Strictly speaking, colonialism is a sort of subset of imperialism, and to some extent different from it. Colonialism has to do with the issue of planting colonies, of sending settlers from one place or one country to another place or another country to spread the civilization of the mother country, so to speak. In fact, in discussing modern imperialism, the terms imperialism and colonialism are often used as synonyms of one another. They're often used as meaning the same thing, though they don't, strictly speaking, mean the same thing. For example, speaking for a moment about British imperialism, the British sent a lot of colonists to Kenya in East Africa. We'll be reading a book from Kenya later on in the semester. But they sent many fewer colonists to Nigeria. And we'll be reading some a book by Chinua Achebe, a Nigerian author, early in the semester. So the British technique and the technique of other colonial powers or imperialist powers was not always, strictly speaking, a colonialist project, colonialist plan. Nevertheless, I will use these terms more or less synonymously, but it's good to keep in mind that under certain circumstances they mean something different. Okay. As recently as the end of the Second World War, a little bit more than 50 years ago, all the world, the entire world, aside from North America, Japan, and Europe, was controlled by some imperialist power or other. That is, the countries of North America, Japan, and Europe, and particularly Western Europe, controlled the whole rest of the globe. And if we go back to the early part of this century, let's say 1914, the beginning of World War I, it would be even larger because Russia was an imperialist country and controlled a tremendous expanse of territory. So that in the late 19th and the first half of the 20th century, most of the peoples of the world lived under the direct rule of either Japan, the late comer among the imperialist powers, a Western European country, or the United States. So this is the recent history of the vast majority of the world's people. The authors that we are reading in this course were all born and grew up during the imperialist era. And the classic imperialist era lasted, at least, let's say, up until 1975, when the last of the European imperialist powers, Portugal, finally abandoned its colonies in Africa, principally Mozambique and Angola. That wasn't until 1975. So this is very recent. The United States, of course, has a history of imperialism, too, that is, as a victim of imperialism. The British were driven out finally at the end of the Revolutionary War in 1783, so that the American Revolution is, in fact, the first revolution in modern times against imperialism. But that's a long time ago. Most Americans' ancestors were not living in the United States at that time. Most of us descend from immigrants who came after the American Revolution, usually long after the American Revolution, and that period of time in American history doesn't have a great deal of resonance to many people today, especially given the rudimentary level of historical instruction in contemporary American schools. It is important to stress that imperialism is an extremely violent, murderous, brutal, and exploitative process. The purposes of imperialism in the modern era, not much different in the classical period, are very clear. They are exploitative. The purpose is, if you want to put it bluntly, to make money, to build wealth. And wealth can be built either by using the colonized or imperialized countries, lands, and people for the production of primary or raw materials, agricultural goods, minerals from mines, timber. So for primary goods or raw materials, it can be used as markets, as the industrializing British textile industry in the 19th century used India as a market, flooding India with cheap cloth goods and driving millions of Indian weavers into literally starving to death. And of course, increasingly as sources of cheap labor. That is important from the very earliest days in the Americas, where slaves were brought from Africa to be used as the cheapest form of labor available at that time. And now there's a lot of investment in areas of the world such as Southeast Asia, Asia generally, East Asia generally, and other parts of the world that are not industrialized, Central America, South America, in the case of American companies, where the population is simply used as very, very cheap labor and therefore very profitable labor. We've probably all heard of the NAFTA agreement that was passed in the early days of the Clinton administration, not too many years ago, the North American Treaty on Free Trade. And as a result of this, as a result of this agreement with Mexico, which stated that goods could cross the border without import and export tariffs, lots of American companies, including big automobile manufacturing plants, just fired their American workers and picked up and moved to Mexico, where the labor rates are a small fraction of what they are in the United States today. Now, the price of cars didn't go down, but the profits of the automobile companies went way up. And that's using an example of imperialism, or in this case, neo-imperialism, for the purposes of cheap labor. As I said, the process of imperialism is extremely violent and brutal. It's been estimated that there were perhaps 10 million Native Americans who lived in within the boundaries of the United States, contemporary United States, in 1492. Some estimates have gone as low as 6 million. But what's for sure is by 1900, there were 600,000. Now, where did all the rest go? They died by various processes, but they all died as a result of the coming of the Europeans to the United States. Many were murdered outright, others died of diseases, which had to do with contacts with Europeans. Others starved to death, but the point is that they were gone. A tremendous Holocaust. Maybe 10 million slaves were shipped off from Africa, and certainly far fewer than half of them made it across the Atlantic. But that was in the early days of imperialism. In the 19th and 20th centuries, there has been a tremendous amount of not only outright murder by the imperialists, Western European, American, Japanese, the people in their colonies, but also enforced poverty, starvation, imprisonment, death by disease, death because of poor conditions. And of course, this has been the case in a somewhat lesser way of the working classes in all of these imperialist countries too. I mean, very poor conditions obtained here. So it's important to recognize the similarity between the tactics of imperialism in colonized countries abroad and the tactics used by the same ruling elites against their own working classes at home. In fact, at the early part of the century, a number of studies of imperialism were published that pointed out that imperialism is an aspect of capitalism. This is an idea that was popularized by Vladimir Lenin, the leader of the Russian Revolution, the communist revolution, a famous communist thinker, but he didn't originate it. It came at least from the British historian Hodson at the early part of the 20th century, and others recognize it as well. Imperialism is a continuation and a more advanced stage of the exploitative process of capitalism, period. Capitalism itself. Now, I'm going to give other examples of the violent and brutal nature of imperialism. Now, let me give you one last example. In the famous Berlin Conference of 1882 to 83, where the major Western imperialist powers sat down to divide up Africa, the United States was present as an observer nation, didn't end up with any colonies in Africa as such. Leopold, King of Belgium, was given the colony that later came to be called the Belgian Congo and is now several countries in the area of the Congo River. A huge colony, unexplored, untapped resource at that time. And in the early part of the century, from about 1902 to about 1905, there was a flurry of exposés by writers of various countries, including some missionaries and others, who exposed that in those 20 years, roughly between 1882 or 1883 and 1902 and 1903, the Belgians had killed about 10 million residents of the Congo in the most brutal possible way. Killed 10 million people in the process of pursuing profit, trying to force them to come up with the goods that they wanted. Now, the process of imperialism and colonialism, therefore, has exposed to the peoples of most of the world the hollowness of Western claims to be champions of civilization, democracy, and freedom. Now, it's important to remember that because it's taken for granted, it's almost assumed in the books that we're reading that the Western imperialist powers do not in fact stand for these aims or these goals. We ourselves going to school, being educated and, as it were, indoctrinated in Western imperialist societies, assimilate very early on the notion that we're taught that Western countries stand for wonderful ideals such as these: freedom, democracy, civilization, and others as well, religion, science, progress. And therefore, we're ill-prepared to understand the suspicion and hostility towards Western imperialists that is extremely widespread in the formerly colonial world. So that subject itself is going to be one that we have to spend some time on in this class. We basically have not been taught about this. I'll give you one example, which I'll come back to when we discuss some literature from Kenya. When I was 10 to 12 years old, there was a major rebellion against British colonialism, against British imperialism going on in Kenya. This was carried on purely by Kenyan nationalists who wanted independence from Great Britain because of British exploitative and murderous policies. The British were bombing these people. There were concentration camps. There were torture chambers, widespread use of torture by the British. This was in the early 1950s. It was either presented on television in the news media, I remember this as a child, either as a communist revolt, occasionally, or more often, the acts of savages who were unaccountably anti-white. At the same time that in the United States and in Western Europe, the horrors or the supposed horrors of communism were being trumpeted abroad. These, of course, were the early years of the Cold War. The British were using Nazi tactics on a grand scale in their colonies, just killing people, torturing people in wholesale lots. It almost never made the news. It certainly never made any news that I saw at that time. So it's the case that our educations are, in fact, imperialist education. it's not presented to us as that. It's presented to us as the truth. But, in fact, a tremendous amount has been left out. And we have to learn some of that so that we can understand the concerns of people in the rest of the world. I've put this theme first because it's the primary theme that affects all the rest. All of the other themes relate to it. It's the fundamental reality that most of the people in the world have faced in very recent times. And we have to spend some time getting used to this idea, or we're just not going to be able to understand these novels, or even the concerns that people have in terms of the rest of the themes. I can give you a couple more examples. When I was your age, more or less during the 1960s, when I was my teens and early 20s, the Vietnam War was raging. The Vietnam War was described to me and to people of my generation in the mass media and by the government as a war against communism. Well, of course, in some sense it was, but what I didn't learn until years after the war was over was that it was a colonial war. The French imperialists had conquered Vietnam, what they came to call Indochina, in the 1880s, and had exploited it very brutally. Various nationalist movements which aimed to get rid of colonialism, and therefore were something like the American Revolutionaries of 1776, cropped up. The French put down these revolts with tremendous brutality. Finally, the Vietnamese communists were successful in organizing millions of Vietnamese peasants mainly, but also intellectuals and to a minor extent workers, and driving the French out. Whereupon the United States stepped in the name of anti-communism. One important topic we're going to talk about later on is the relationship of imperialism to anti-communism, how anti-communism is used as a kind of cover for imperialist motives and imperialist practices. And one final thing I'd like to say here, though there are lots of other examples that I'll bring up in the course of the semester, imperialism isn't dead. Classical imperialism, in which the government figures and the military of an imperialist country directly govern another country, that has all but vanished. But neo-imperialism, as it's called, in which the imperialist country supports a local ruling elite, and the local ruling elite then controls the country and does the exploiting on behalf of the distant neo-imperialist powers, the same industrial powers that were the imperialist powers at one time, that process continues, so that in almost every country that was a colony, that was subject to imperialism, there is a ruling elite which maintains power and is given a cut of the spoils, so to speak, largely on behalf of the foreign imperialist countries today. So that neo-imperialism is an extremely important process. And towards the end of our course, we'll take a look at a book or two that deal with that process. But just to reiterate, this is the primary theme. It's important to understand how it gives the lie to Western claims of altruism and humanity and civilization and democracy. It was extremely violent, brutal, and above all, exploitative. And keep these things in mind when we discuss the other themes. Thank you.